Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a potential crisis facing a White House in chaos, with yet another staff shakeup as Anthony Scaramucci, the newly appointed Director of Communications, was shown the door today. In response to the latest North Korean missile test and threats coming from the White House, a bipartisan group of top American officials who have had high-level dealings with North Korea, William Perry, George Shultz, Robert Gallucci, Sig Hecker, Richard Lugar, and Bill Richardson, have written to President Trump urging him to open direct talks with Kim Jong-un. Adam Mount, the former project director of the Council on Foreign Relations Independent Task Force, chaired by Admiral Mullen and Sam Nunn, joins us to discuss how a dysfunctional White House will deal with a clear and present danger that does not lend itself to military force or rhetorical bluster, but rather requires mature and patient diplomacy. Then, with Putin kicking out American diplomats in a tit-for-tat Cold War reprisal, we'll examine Putin's comments today that in their recent G20 meeting, Trump agreed with Putin's version of whether Russia meddled in our elections. David Halperin, who served on the National Security Council and was counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee, joins us to discuss his article at the Huffington Post, The Exxon Treasury Fight, and the roots of Russiagate, which lays out a credible scenario of what the real ties are between Putin and Trump and why it appears that Trump is Putin's puppet. Then finally, we will speak with Catherine Stewart, the author of The Good News Club, The Christian Right's Stealth Assault on America's Children, about her article in the New York Times, What the Government Schools, in quote, critics really mean. She traces the history of attacks on so-called government schools, meaning public education, by religious fundamentalists who now have a champion in the new Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, who has funded crusades casting public schools as godless government indoctrination camps. And joining us now is Adam Mound, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, where he focuses on nuclear security. Previously, he was a Stanton Nuclear Security Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and worked on nuclear elimination contingencies at the RAND Corporation and was the project director at the Council on Foreign Relations Independent Task Force, chaired by Admiral Mike Mullen and Senator Sam Nunn. Welcome to Background Briefing, Adam Mound.
Thank you.
And the letter that was sent to the White House that was signed by William Perry, the former Secretary of Defense under Bill Clinton, George Shultz, the Secretary of State under Ronald Reagan, Robert Gallucci, who was the chief U.S. negotiator during the North Korean nuclear crisis of 1994, Sig Hecker, the former director of Los Alamos National Laboratory, who's visited North Korea seven times, and former Republican Senator Richard Lugar, who chaired the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and Bill Richardson, the former Secretary of Energy and another frequent visitor to North Korea. You couldn't have a more heft in that group. But what they're telling Trump is that you should open talks with Kim Jong-un. And meanwhile, Trump is making vague threats and saying he's going to take care of it without being specific. And we know that there have been other threats made by members of his administration. So how do you feel about this White House in chaos sort of stumbling into what might be its first real crisis?
You know, I think you characterized this exactly right. That letter that was written by Bill Perry and Sig Hecker and others was really sort of the demigods of American North Korea policy. And in some ways, that was the clearest statement about that I've seen about what we ought to do going forward. They suggested immediate direct talks right away. And, you know, I think that they're exactly right, that that is the only possibility that stands the chance of halting these tests. North Korea now, as of a couple of days ago, has decisively proven its ability to launch a nuclear warhead at the continental United States. That has been the threshold that we've been trying to prevent for 21 years since the first nuclear test. And, you know, now that we've crossed this threshold, there's some folks sort of falling back on their old positions, looking to play for more time, trying to deny that they have this capability, or thinking about military strikes. If we were going to carry out military strikes, the time to do that was 5 years ago when they had not gained this capability. But now that ship ought to have sailed. So, you know, I think Bill Perry and the others are right that there's a slim chance, not a very strong chance. We can't rely on this possibility, but there's a slim chance that Kim Jong-un would accept talks to cap his missile tests and accept a notional, but maybe not a reliable ICBM capability. I think it's worth trying, but I also think that the Trump administration lacks the flexibility to go ahead with that policy. So, you know, I expect us to continue to sort of stay the course, to drift.
Well, one doesn't expect rationality from Donald Trump, let alone subtlety. But I recall years ago speaking with Paul Netzer, who was something of an eminence in American foreign policy, and he said that during the time of Soviet expansion into Africa, when there was all that paranoia about them taking over Ethiopia and Angola and all this stuff, that he and a few other people floated the idea of strategic indigestion. In other words, allowing the Russians to basically take over as many places as they wanted to, because eventually they were going to implode, which is what they did do. They could barely take care of their own people, let alone the Eastern European countries who had a higher standard of living than the people back in Russia. And on top of that, all of these other African states. Now, needless to say, that didn't fly. But is there a possibility in this case, if you're going to talk to the North Koreans, could you be a little subtle about it? And you know, the Korean War hasn't ended. It's an armistice, not a peace treaty. And more or less, you know, declare peace. What would Kim Jong-un do without the American enemy?
Unfortunately, I think Kim Jong-un is always going to have the American scapegoat that he can use to, you know, maintain internal control and to paint as the enemy to his populace in really quite stark and dramatic terms oftentimes. You know, many North Koreans they're raised on a diet to think that the United States is a genocidal and corrupt power that's aiming at their liquidation. You know, it helps him preserve internal control like other autocrats have done through history. I think that there is a package that we could put on the table that would be in the interest of the North Korean people and Kim Jong-un. I think it would involve larger concessions than we've contemplated in the past. It would require major economic incentives. It would require us to moderate at least our rhetorical objectives for what talks would be, right? We can't expect them to denuclearize before talks begin, which is what this administration has said the precondition is. That's just not going to happen. If they hold to that condition, talks will quite frankly never occur. So what I think the plan ought to be for the long run is a long-term policy of containment and deterrence to try to maintain stability on the peninsula. Now that they have this ICBM weapon, the objective is to prevent them from being able to use it or from deciding to use it. So, it's not a politically satisfying answer. Through the last 10 or 20 years, a lot of U.S.-North Korea policy has been dictated more by what sounds comforting to the American populace than by actually seeking a solution on the peninsula. And now we've come, you know, face to face with the failure of American policy. And that doesn't mean that we have a good or easy option. It means that now we have to manage a problem for the long term because the alternatives are unsustainable. So doing that will mean seeking, you know, some kind of arms control regime on the peninsula, long-term deterrence and containment, reprioritizing the American alliances in the region, which the Trump administration has been mixed on. You know, so it's not a comforting message, but I think that that's the best option that we have, and we need to get on with it.
And again, I'm speaking with Adam Mount, the senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, who was the project director at the Council on Foreign Relations Independent Task Force, chaired by Admiral Mike Mullen and Sam Nunn. Well, I know that was a very naive question that I floated there, but nevertheless, you know, the path that we've been on forever has been ridiculous, and the idea that, you know, that, for example, George W. Bush, of course, you know, called Kim Jong-un's father all kinds of names. And once you've called them names, you still have to deal with them. They're not going away. They're probably the most disgusting regime on the planet. It's a criminal enterprise, effectively. And it's not really anything to do with communism, as far as I can tell. It's more like the kind of emperor worship fanaticism of Imperial Japan in the 1930s. So there's not, it doesn't seem there's much we can do about it. And we keep trying to make the Chinese do our job for us. They've made it clear that they don't want to. I suspect that the Russians are actually being quite mendacious, because something has to explain the extraordinary technological developments that are underway in North Korea, how they so quickly moved to this capability and just in the last couple of years. So, again, I think the point is that this is going to require mature, patient diplomacy, right? And no more saber rattling. Do you think this letter is going to have an effect?
Do I think what's going to have an effect?
This letter. In other words, the elder statesman trying to tell Trump that no more saber rattling, let's talk to this guy.
I wish it would, but the Trump administration and Mr. Trump personally has said from the start that the Iran deal was the worst deal that, you know, has ever been made in the history of the country. And that was clearly an overstatement. That's clearly false, right? The Iran deal has prevented Iran from getting to the point where North Korea is now. If you're interested in seeing another North Korea, walk away from the Iran deal. So the fact is they don't have any sort of faith in diplomacy or their ability to hold a recalcitrant regime to a tough deal. If we were going to do some kind of denuclearization deal with North Korea, or even a test freeze, a limit on those programs, it would be a much messier and even less satisfying deal than the Iran deal was. So they clearly don't have an interest in doing that. I wish that they would consider that. I wish they would come to that reality, but they look as though they're moving. They're not moving in that direction. So to answer your previous question, a peace treaty is something that could be part of a wider package of negotiations after Kim Jong-un sets himself onto the road of denuclearizing. I think that's something that's worth discussing. It's something we should be willing to discuss, but it's clearly not all there is to it. I think that offer is not sufficient to get him to a deal on denuclearization or even a test freeze limit. He has gained a deterrent capability, which is quite frankly valuable to him. So one of the options that we should consider over the long run, which former Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights Tom Malinowski published in Politico recently, was to say we should plan to reform the regime by transmitting information to ordinary Koreans to allow them to reform their own country over the long term. It's not a forcible regime change policy, but it's a way of achieving detente and trying to forge a stable and peaceful Northeast Asia, which is manifestly in the interests of the United States and also of our allies. It's not satisfying. It's not an immediate short-term plan, but it stands the best chance of avoiding nuclear war over the long run.
Well, we already know that that the North Koreans' secret police go around looking for South Korean videotapes that are smuggled in of soap operas and other things that show that the government lies about this, that the standard of living in the South being so infinitely greater than theirs. And one of the techniques they use to trap people is they turn off power in various areas and the VCRs get jammed. So they're obviously very paranoid. And of course, you can make the case that it wasn't nuclear weapons that ended the Cold War with the Soviet Union, but MTV and rock and roll. So that's certainly an avenue to pursue. But my sense is that the Chinese and to now, I think the Russians, now that Putin's pretty much determined that the main enemy is really the enemy again, I suspect there was some help there given to the that's accelerated the North Korean program. But from the Chinese point of view, my understanding is that they don't mind the fact that the North Korean nuclear program drives us crazy, drives the Japanese crazy, and drives the South Koreans crazy, and has the capability of neutralizing the American fleet and Guam, etc. Is that the same logic, that since they've got a stable deterrence with a pretty low number of nuclear weapons, the Chinese, but they've got this wild card, the North Koreans, in the same way that the U.S. has basically, to some extent, had Israel as a wild card in the Middle East, as you recall, during the lead-up to the Iraq war, whether or not Israel would respond to the Scud missile attacks from Saddam Hussein was a bit of a wild card. So is there that element there that, in other words, the Chinese, at least the hardliners, think, yeah, North Korea drives the Americans crazy, that's a good thing?
You know, this is certainly in keeping with the Russian modus operandi, which is to complicate American calculus and American interests all around the world, to say that even if they can't sort of stand up to American power and halt the spread of liberal and Western ideas, you know, at the very least, they can make it difficult and costly to do so. And so in the past, you know, certainly 5 years, but much, much further before that, Russia has tried to complicate American interests and activity all around the world. And so I think you're exactly right that Russia is undergoing a transition on North Korea. For many years, they were cooperative in the UN Security Council on new sanctions. They were disapproving of North Korea's program. Now you're seeing increasing levels of trade. And I personally am concerned that they could move towards increased diplomatic recognition. That's how the Russians operate. They prop up illiberal regimes that are inimical to American interests, and so that's something we need to be aware of, and we need to combat. Because if Russia opens the floodgates, then it makes it far more difficult to contain a dangerous and, as you said, criminal regime. There's no evidence that I'm aware of in the public source system that says that Russia has helped their nuclear and missile programs in recent years. There's some evidence that the Chinese have, that the trucks that erect and launch North Korean intermediate-range ballistic missiles and also ICBMs come from China. That's something that they ought to stop. But you're also right that Trump has put far too much emphasis on China solving the problem. It's clear by now that they're not going to do it. And so you saw Trump tweet for months and months that the Chinese are being very helpful behind closed doors. We're just going to give them some more time. And now he's finally realized that strategy was untenable. I worry that we wasted many critical months on that. It's just imperative that they start to raise their eyes from the horizon, take a dispassionate look at the various options, and understand that a long-term containment policy is in America's best interest.
Well, just in closing, of course, the Russians aren't importing more and more North Korean slave labor in the Pacific, their Pacific East, and Vladivostok, and et cetera. But just back to Kim Jong-un and his father, it would seem to me that surely they learned the lessons that Saddam Hussein, from Saddam Hussein, with George W. Bush and company, going to war against him on the false basis that he had weapons of mass destruction. And had he had weapons of mass destruction, he may be able to have prevented that invasion. I should think the lesson to people like the North Korean regime was, well, you better get weapons of mass destruction as soon as possible if the Americans are out for regime change.
They may have drawn that lesson. They could also look at the Libyan experience, and that's an unfortunate consequence of our actions in those arenas. Kim Jong-un is often parodied in American media as being crazy or unhinged or irrational, but there's a clear logic here, which is that nuclear deterrence, you know, keeps the United States from invading and imposing regime change without provocation. Now, that doesn't mean that deterrence is going to be easy over the long run. It's a constant struggle to maintain it, As it becomes more complex, as the North Koreans improve their military capabilities all the way across the board. But, you know, we're just going to have to remain vigilant and restrained, both in the months to come and in the years to come.
And, of course, I saw a report on TV the other night of the island of Hawaii is now worried about civil defense. They're going to build, go back and put people inside the tunnels under Diamond Head. We're not exactly reacting very rationally already, so I guess we'll stay tuned. I thank you for joining us, Adam Mount.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Adam Mount, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, where he focuses on nuclear security. Previously, he was a Stanton Nuclear Security Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, worked on nuclear elimination contingencies at the RAND Corporation, and was the project director at the Council on Foreign Relations Independent Task Force, chaired by Admiral Mike Mullen and Sam Nunn. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into why Trump is Putin's puppet.
From Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is David Halpern, who's a senior fellow at Republic Report, who was previously a special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. His latest article at the Huffington Post and Republic Report is The Exxon Treasury Fight and the Roots of Russiagate. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Halpern.
Thanks, Ian.
And let's start out with, obviously, there's been a tit-for-tat sort of Cold War-like reprisal from Vladimir Putin expelling 755 American diplomats. But he also, today on television, Vladimir Putin gave his version of what happened in these G20 meetings, which, of course, there was no record of. The Trump administration made sure that Fiona Hill was not there, who speaks Russian and would have taken notes. Putin already vetoed her as being a hardliner. It was only the two businessmen, Trump and Tillerson, and these two pros from the Russian side and translators. But it turns out what Putin is saying is that Trump agreed with him, his version of that we didn't meddle in the American election. And Trump apparently just took that at face value. So that is, who do you believe, Trump or Putin?
Well, I believe actually both of them, because I think they were saying the same thing. When the late or departed Anthony Scaramucci was on TV when he first got his job at the White House, he said, you know, maybe it seems to me that if the Russians had really meddled in our election, the Russians are so smooth and so good at hacking that we would have never have known it was them. And the host, Jake Tapper, said, well, who was this person who told you this idea? And Scaramucci said, okay, it was Donald Trump. But then a couple days later, there was an article in the paper that indicated that, in fact, Trump got that idea from Putin. Putin floated it, and Trump seemed to agree with him, according to the fact that Trump then passed that theory on to Scaramucci. So I think that, in fact, Trump agreed. Now, Trump often seems to be like somebody's aunt who always agrees with the last person that she spoke with. So it's possible that someone else could persuade Trump otherwise. But Trump has a lot riding on believing Putin's version of this, because he has his pride in believing that he won the election without help from the Russians, and or he's covering up the fact that he knows he won the election with help from the Russians.
So let's turn to your article at the Republic Report in the Huffington Post, The Exxon Treasury fight and the roots of Russiagate? Because it seems to me that you're laying out a fairly credible record here of why it is that Trump appears to be Putin's puppet.
Yes. What it seems to me was there was either an explicit deal or a tacit understanding between Putin and Trump. What Trump wanted was the prize of being president of the United States, which is ego gratifying and also potentially could make a lot of money for him. And what Putin wanted potentially was to have a president who's more like his puppet. But most of all, Putin wanted the sanctions lifted. And if you look at every U.S.-Russia encounter that's now come out, or Trump-Russia encounter that's come out in the last few months in the Russiagate investigation and the various leaks of it, the Russians are always asking for the same thing. At the Trump Tower meeting in June 2016, the Magnitsky Act, that was about lifting the sanctions. When the calls that Flynn got in trouble speaking with Ambassador Kislyak in December 2016, the Russians were asking about lifting the sanctions. There was an article in the New York Times in February. That is what the Russians want. Over and over again, we see it, that because the sanctions are killing Russia's economy, especially killing a deal between Exxon and Rosneft, the Russian state oil company, for drilling in the Arctic Sea. That's what the Russians want unblocked so that they can start pumping or exploring for and then pumping oil out of the Arctic Sea so that the Russians can reassert their primacy in the energy world. And so, again and again, that's what Putin asked for. And Trump was saying, as a candidate, over and over, I think we should consider lifting the sanctions. So whether or not they ever came together and, you know, signed a contract or discussed this, Putin wanted the sanctions lifted, Trump said he would, and then the Russians worked to help Trump get elected.
Well, you know, some of the scenarios, like the Manchurian candidate, suggest that there's a weird, some kind of hold, you know, and there's been this sort of honey trap idea has been floated when he was there for the Miss Universe in 2013, etc. But there's also a very logical explanation in terms of a different kind of honey trap, and that is the money trap, where it's clear that after Trump got blackballed by Wall Street after taking four bankruptcies and taking a bunch of Wall Street banks down, that he couldn't find any money, and a relationship developed between him and a lot of Russian oligarchs, and also some from the former republics in the South, which are notoriously corrupt. You know, the son, Donald Trump Jr., said that that's where they get most of their money from. Is it possible that through these oligarchs, which are effectively Putin's cutouts, that Putin could have reeled him in slowly by just getting him on the take?
Yes, it's definitely a possibility. I think the honey part is plausible. The money part is even more plausible. And then, as I suggested, that, you know, they share a lot of other things, Putin and Trump, you know. They both appeal to the white nationalists out there. They both like attacking the media and the judiciary in their country. And I don't know if Putin is much of a drinker. Trump is not, but they clearly, their favorite beverage, both of them, is fossil fuels, oil and gas. And the fact that they're both trying to get rich off being the leaders of their country. So there's just too many things drawing them together to keep this bromance from happening. And then the other factor in this puzzle to piece together is ExxonMobil. ExxonMobil stood to benefit, like Russia did, from the lifting of the sanctions. And we saw last week the Treasury Department said ExxonMobil violated the sanctions in 2014. It has to pay a $2 million fine. Also, in April of this year, ExxonMobil asked for permission. Could they lift some of the sanctions so that they could do some drilling? The Treasury denied that. And, of course, who was named Secretary of State on the recommendation of Condoleezza Rice and Bob Gates? Rex Tillerson. It turned out that Condoleezza Rice and Bob Gates were at a consulting firm that represents ExxonMobil. So the idea, I think, was get Tillerson in there. That cements the relationship and leads the way to lifting the sanctions and having Trump and Putin kind of rule the world together. The problem is it's all backfired now, and every one of those players is a loser now as a result of what they tried to do. Of course, American people are losers, too, because we have Donald Trump as president. But Trump has paralyzed because of Russiagate. Putin did not get the sanctions lifted, and indeed, Trump is now being forced to sign a bill to tighten the sanctions. Exxon didn't get the sanctions, and Tillerson is completely at sea and lost and ineffective as our Secretary of State.
And again, I'm speaking with David Halperin, a senior fellow at Republic Report, who was previously a special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. His latest article at the Huffington Post and Republic Report is The Exxon Treasury Fight and the Roots of Russiagate. Of course, the deal that you're talking about, the Exxon Rosneft deal, was actually made. That's why Putin gave Rex Tillerson a medal. But it's been on hold. And of course, the sad and sick part about this deal is that to open up the Arctic oil, that's predicated upon the effects of global warming, which, of course, Exxon and these oil companies and the coal companies are the main accelerators of. So if this deal were to go through, and I think we should all praise the Lord, if you're religious at all, David, praise the Lord that it didn't go through.
Get religion soon.
Yeah, because of the fate of the planet. I mean, I can see why the Russians wanted to open up the Kara Sea and also the gas in Siberia, pipe it into China and the Asian markets, and make them as dependent upon Russia as Western Europe is on Gazprom. There's an awful lot of logic to the Russian position. But at the end of the day, isn't this the last hurrah for big oil?
Well, it might or might not be. Trump's view is, let's have American energy supremacy, or whatever he said, American energy dominance. So Trump thinks we can do this for a long time because he doesn't care about global warming, and he's filled his cabinet with people who don't care about global warming. And as you said, the possibility of drilling in the Arctic is made possible by global warming. And just as Exxon must have been sharing with the Russians the idea of how soon they could drill based on global warming, they're at the same time denying and funding all kinds of American organizations that were denying to the American public that global warming is happening. So all of these people, Trump, Putin, Exxon, are all happy with a world where we pretend climate change is not happening, or we don't care if it is, because there's a lot of money to be made in the meantime. Now, America's not going to benefit if ultimately that kind of deal goes forward. It will put the Russians, it will create a larger global glut. The Russians will get more of a share of it, but oil prices will go down. Americans are teaching the Russians, or Exxon will be teaching the Russians to frack under this deal, unleashing more Russian natural gas. So it will make Exxon great again. It will make Russia great again. It really isn't going to help the American worker or the American consumer at all.
And it's going to screw the planet.
Climate change. That's right.
And it's going to screw the planet. So just back to the scenarios, because there seems to be so much denial. The biggest denier about the Russian collusion, of course, is Trump himself. But there's also a lot of Republicans. It doesn't rate with his base. I think about 1% of them, of the 35% that support Trump, even think it's important. They think it's a sort of liberal media cabal trying to do in their guy. A lot of people on the left here at Pacifica and those other outlets like The Nation, etc., also keep making apologies for Putin. I mean, it's pretty pathetic. At the end of the day, they're just going to be so obviously so wrong. But one of the biggest excuses or defenses is that why would Trump want Putin to have backed Trump, because Trump was not going to win? Well, he didn't have to win. That wasn't, if you think about the thinking of the KGB guy, Vladimir Putin, Glavny Protivnik, that's the whole mindset of the KGB, the main enemy. And that's his focus. So, the idea is to screw the Americans one way or the other. It doesn't matter to him how it happens. And he's won. It's a win-win. Had Hillary Clinton won, and she would have won narrowly, Donald Trump and his 35% of diehard supporters would, to this day, would be chanting, lock her up, lock her up, and making life miserable for Hillary Clinton and diminishing her ability to govern. So it didn't matter to him whether Trump won or Hillary Clinton won. He hated her. He wanted to do as much damage to her as possible. and the guy that he owns, he's perfectly happy to have him. You know, it's a bonus that he won, but then that hasn't panned out because he hasn't delivered on what he thought he'd deliver on, or what he promised to, obviously promised Putin. But still, it's a win. America's in chaos. America's weakened.
That's right. He's not going to get the sanctions. That was number one. But he does get a consolation prize. America is in chaos. It's created a huge rift between us and our allies in Europe and in Asia. We're being laughed at. That's right. Weaken Hillary was one way to go. And when people say, well, that must have been his only goal because Trump was never going to win, Trump did win. it's a plus to be conspiring or supporting a total buffoon who has the potential to get support, and that's what they did.
So when do you think it's going to be clear? Because it's just too much smoke not to have fire. And, you know, those people who say, where's the evidence? Where's the evidence? I don't know what more evidence. I mean, I know we've been speculating, but there's still an awful lot of evidence. And the impression I get is that the reason Trump went crazy recently over Sessions was that his lawyers told him that that Robert Mueller, the special counsel, already had his tax return. So we know that Trump absolutely was brazen, like no other president or presidential candidate, as he refused to reveal his taxes. You have to ask the question, why? Why has this guy got away with that so far? I don't think at the end of the day he's going to get away with all of it. He's done pretty well so far by his, you know, hardline tactics of using the law as a weapon to beat up on his enemies and as a way to skirt culpability.
Well, it is really hard to predict what will happen. What I do think is happening, I do believe already there's a very strong case that Trump engaged in obstruction of justice just based on the things that we already know about the firing of Comey and his motivation for it. And that was to stop the investigation, at least of Flynn, if not of Moore, and really of Moore. There's plenty of circumstantial evidence of collusion with Russia. There's certainly going to be findings that various Trump associates, in my view, engaged in improper financial transactions vis-a-vis Russian entities. And so it will add up. And so the question is, how will Trump stop it? He tried to stop it by firing James Comey, and everyone just sort of sat flat-footed at that. It was so stunning. Now we know it's totally telegraphed that he's trying to figure out a way to stop the Mueller investigation. And so I think that we have to sound the alarm and have as many Republicans as possible in advance say, we will not just sort of grumble at that, but we will ask the House to start an impeachment inquiry and be ready to do that if, in fact, it happens. If Trump fires Mueller, he ought to be impeached per se, because every reasonable person, Republican, in his Justice Department thought that was the right thing to do in the circumstance to avoid obstruction of justice. So I think that the only thing to do is hope and pray and pressure for enough integrity from Republicans that there's an impeachment inquiry. And if Mueller doesn't get that, and if he actually is fired, hope that there will be some kind of movement in the Justice Department to keep the investigation going. If Trump basically takes over the Justice Department, which is possible, our country is not immune from the kind of things that happen in other countries, then everything gets leaked to the media and the public pressure gets so strong and let the truth come out that way, that ultimately either Trump loses or Trump is forced to resign, or Trump loses the election. My concern after that is, even if he lost the election, it's going to be hard to get him to leave. And at that point, the military might have to become involved. The man is a disgrace. He's a menace. Everyone who elected him bears responsibility for the mess that we're in. And I'm hopeful, because some of our institutions, like the judiciary and the press, are strong enough that we will find our way out of this.
Well, do you think, just in closing, that he's made it clear that he's angry at Sessions because Sessions didn't stop the investigation? He's made it clear that he wants to get rid of Mueller. There's no secret about it. It's extraordinary that people don't see the writing on the wall there. But do you think he's trying to he's brought in Kelly from Homeland Security to open up Homeland Security, then to force Sessions into that job, for which he's well suited?
I don't know if he's going to be able to get away with that. But here's what I'm really concerned about, if you give me 30 more seconds, which is that Kelly and Trump share this: immigration, scaring people about immigration, scaring people about terrorism. With Bannon in the mix, they could have a more disciplined operation that focused on those things, which actually helped Trump with his base and even with some of the swing voters. We're about law and order. We're about fighting, getting rid of immigrants. We're about fighting terrorism. And that message could actually, if there was some discipline to it, get Trump back on the offensive and help him to restore this completely failed presidency. And that really worries me.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, David Halperin.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with David Halperin, who's a senior fellow at Republic Report, who was previously a special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. His latest article at the Huffington Post and Republic Report is Exxon Treasury Fight and the Roots of Russiagate. We're going to take a brief station break, back looking into the Christian jihad against what they call government schools.
Excuse me, mister, but is that natural? Oil in the sea and the pollution in the air, mister. Whose could that be? So excuse me, mister, but I'm a mister too, and you're giving mister a bad name, mister, like you. So I'm taking the mister from
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Catherine Stewart, a journalist whose recent work has appeared in The New York Times, The Nation, The Atlantic, and The Guardian. She's the author of The Good News Club, The Christian Right's Stealth Assault on America's Children, and she has an op-ed at The New York Times, What the Government Schools Critics Really Mean. Welcome to Background Briefing, Catherine Stewart.
Thank you so much for having me.
And in your New York Times article, Catherine, you mentioned that President Trump's school choice, his budget for school choice, would cut more than $9 billion for overall education spending, but he also wants to put money into charter schools and voucher programs. And in announcing this budget, Trump talked about the failing government schools. So he used that phrase, government schools, and that is a loaded term, and there's a history to it. So let's talk about that. It's a loaded term, and tell us about the history.
Well, it certainly is a loaded term, and in certain conservative circles, that term, government schools, has become really quite ubiquitous. And I think a lot of people fail to understand that there's a certain segment of the evangelical world that has never accepted public education as a legitimate enterprise to begin with. They think that public schools are secular and they're going to turn their children away from their religion. And they therefore would like to sort of destroy the public schools. And, you know, it's actually kind of part of a two-pronged strategy. I write about this a lot in my book. A lot of religious right wants to force their programs into the public schools through after-school clubs and through history textbooks that promote a Christian nationalist version of American history, and by promoting creationism in public schools and things like that. But it's part of really a two-pronged strategy. They want to sort of force their programs into the public schools, but have, I think, arrived at this idea that a better means of the attack would be to destroy public schools altogether, by stripping them of funding, through voucher programs and unregulated charters. And this is where you hear a lot of the language about government schools.
Well, some of it, of course, is extraordinarily hyperbolic, but nevertheless, I'm sure heartfelt by some of these zealots that that these government schools are prisons for poor children, that they're government indoctrination camps.
That's language that you hear today in a lot of the right-wing policy institutes that are funded either directly or indirectly by the DeVos family. Her family funded the Mackinac Center, the Acton Institute, and the Heartland Institute, and articles appear in their websites and through their publications sort of decrying government schools, as you said, command and control mentality, prisons for poor children, and things like that. You know, the vitriol has a real pedigree. When many leaders of the Christian right talk about public schools, it's hard to believe that they're talking about the same places that our kids, you know, learn their ABCs and their multiplication tables. But the fury from the Christian nationalists is so total and uncompromising, it's hard to imagine that it could be satisfied by anything short of destruction of the system. It goes all the way back to 19th century theologians such as A.A. Hodge, who was at Princeton Seminary, who predicted in 1890 that public education would become he called an efficient and wide instrument for the propagation of atheism. He wrote, "I am as sure as I am as of Christ's reign that a comprehensive and centralized system of national as education will prove the most appalling engineering for the propagation of anti-Christian and atheistic unbelief and antisocial nihilistic ethics." And this kind of rhetoric has been continued on by other sort of leaders of the religious right. Rushduni, who was one of the leaders of Dominionism, this idea that government, all aspects of government, should be overtaken by control of Christians like himself, said something like, you know, evolutionary, socialistic, one world. It's chaos, primitivism, and a vast integration into the void. James Kennedy, whose ministry received over $5.5 million from the Prince DeVos family, said in 1986, the infusion of an atheistic, amoral, evolutionary, one-world, anti-American system of education in public schools has become such, if it had been done by an enemy, it would be considered an act of war. That's actually a quote that gets repeated over and over and over. It was repeated very recently by Anita Staver, who is I believe she's the president of Liberty Council, one of the sort of right-wing Christian legal advocacy groups that's always arguing, you know, behind the cases like Hobby Lobby and things like that. So this kind of rhetoric, it's anti-public education rhetoric, has a long pedigree, and it's never, frankly, I don't think it's ever been louder than it is today.
And it's got a champion who's the Secretary of Education. And again, I'm speaking with Catherine Stewart, a journalist whose recent work has appeared in the New York Times, The Nation, The Atlantic, and The Guardian. She's the author of The Good News Club, The Christian Right's Stealth Assault on America's Children, and has an op-ed at The New York Times, What the Government Schools Critics Really Mean. So let's talk about your book. And it came about because you had a personal experience, right, that your kids were being indoctrinated. In 2009, The Good News Club came to the public elementary school where your kids were, and they were sponsored by the Child Evangelism Fellowship, which bills itself as an after-school program for Bible study, but it was anything but. So walk us through that personal experience.
Well, yes, thank you for mentioning that. I really wasn't tuned into this issue about the religious right's attack on public education until I discovered a Good News Club was coming to our daughter's public elementary school. And frankly, at first, I just thought, wow, that's great. What could be wrong with a group with such a very nice name? And but I discovered that the group seeks to indoctrinate very young children in evangelical Christianity by confusing them into thinking, really deceiving them into thinking that the religion of the club is sponsored by the school. they target children in the very first years of learning, ages 5 and 6 years old. The centerpiece of their program is called a wordless book. It's got no words, just pictures and shapes and colors, and it's used to convert children who are too young to read. And little kids have, we're talking little kids here, that public schools have a cloak of authority in their minds. They think if something is taught in their school, it must be sponsored by their school. It must be what their school wants them to believe. They can't make a distinction between something that's taught in their school and something that's sponsored by their school. And the Good News Club leaders know that very well. That's why they're so insistent on putting these clubs in public schools where they're going to be targeting very, very young children. So in our community in Santa Barbara, a group of parents got together, evangelical parents, by the way, who are, you know, share some of the beliefs of the Good News Club leaders, but didn't think that the club was right for our school because they knew how divisive and inappropriate it was. So they offered the club leaders free space in a church literally next door to the school, the Montecito Covenant Church. It's an evangelical church, very beautiful. The Good News Club leaders declined, and they insisted on being in the public school. So I started to ask questions like, why do they want to be in the public schools? You know, what is the religion of the Good News Club? And, you know, what are their goals for our community and our schools? And, you know, I discovered that they are part of that sector of the religious right that really wants to exploit public schools by using them to promote their religion and deceive children into thinking that the school supports this kind of Christian nationalist agenda.
But, you know, and of course the dominionism, which is what you're referring to there, is that's Rush Dooney's legacy. It actually came up a little bit in the last election. Ted Cruz's father is a dominionist, but you can't argue that they've been that successful. But you can make the case, as indeed you do in your New York Times article, Catherine Stewart, that the history of these so-called government schools go back to before the Jim Crow era, but they were accelerated during the Jim Crow era. And before the Civil War, the South was largely free of public schools. And then during Reconstruction, this Confederate Army chaplain, Robert Lewis Dabney, led this attack on government schools. I see it in a broader context, and that is, you know, that the public schools are the sort of last sort of legacy of social democracy that we have left in this country, and that the South, of course, being somewhat feudal with the plantation economy, is now the home of the Republican Party. There's been, you know, they didn't even have public schools, as you point out, before the Civil War, but they've been hostile, and that's where most of this hostility via religion that you're talking about is, that you can actually trace the destruction of public education in this country to the rise of the American plutocracy that now threatens democracy itself.
Well, it's really interesting that you make that link. It's true that today, 90% of American children attend public schools, and for many citizens, the schools provide their most basic form of engagement with democracy. They call them government schools, but they're not run by the big bad government. In fact, our school boards are locally elected, and for many people, engagement with the public schools and the whole and the town or cities that they live in, it's the most direct form of engagement with our democratic principles. Local boards we elect and taxation with representation that they support have proved to be not the engine of atheism, but frankly, of a thriving middle class, if you look at the broad sweep of history. So the government schools crowd really is seeking to persuade us that our own democracy and the tools of our democracy, the tools of our own democracy are malign.
Well, that's why the DeVos family and the Koch brothers have something in common. The Koch brothers want to get rid of public education because they're fanatical libertarians who don't believe that there should be a government role in anything, and they should be unfettered to do what they want to do. And the DeVos people have a similar sort of plutocratic outlook, but I think they're more motivated. I mean, the Kochs are somewhat secular, but the DeVos people are are quite imbued with religious zeal, are they not?
Yes, they are. In fact, Betsy DeVos, you know that she's at the intersection of two families that have funded the radical Christian right. In 1983, her father, Edgar Prince, contributed to the creation of the Family Research Council, which the Southern Poverty Law Center identifies as extremist because of its anti-LGBT language. Her father-in-law has been funding groups and causes on the economic and religious right since the 1970s. Now, this is something that she probably wishes that people weren't that aware of, but a 2001 gathering of conservative Christian philanthropists called The Gathering, she singled out education reform, you know, the sort of what they call school choice, as a way to, quote, advance God's kingdom. In an interview, she and her husband, Dick DeVos Jr., said that school choice would lead to what they called greater kingdom gain. So they're kind of quiet about that aspect of their focus. In fact, I believe that her husband, Dick DeVos Jr., said at one point, we have to be, you know, kind of, I'm going to paraphrase him. He said we need to be kind of quiet about this agenda. It was in a 2002 lecture to the Heritage Foundation, but I don't have the exact language on me. But this is part of their purpose of involving themselves in public education.
And at the end of the day, you know, it's against science, it's against intellectual curiosity, it's against rationality and reason, and it could have dire consequences for this country if it hasn't already, because as Thomas Jefferson said, an ignorant people cannot remain a free people.
Yes, it's one of my favorite quotes.
It is?
Thank you for saying that. It's true. It is. You know, when they say freedom, when they bemoan our government indoctrination camps that threaten our nation's very survival and, you know, talk about the importance of freedom, what they really want is freedom from democracy itself. And I think that this idea that any kind of democratic institutions or, you know, democratic engagement by the citizenry is dangerous for them. It goes back again to that time when you had that Reverend Dabney and was arguing against public education so forcefully. The interesting thing about Dabney is he goes on and on. You know, he really dislikes public education, but what he really, really dislikes is freedom of is equality. He was an absolute avid defender of slavery in essay after essay after essay. And I wouldn't really repeat some of the things that he said about enslaved people, because they were just really hateful and horrific. But he was a devotee of Calhoun, that great Confederate. And they were the reason why they hated democracy, because they felt like it interfered with their property rights as people who had the right to enslave others. I mean, this is really where a lot of that comes from. And if you want to defend slavery and absolute brutal inequality, of course you're going to hate education.
Well, Catherine Stewart, I thank you very much for joining us here today. We've run out of time, but I appreciate you joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Catherine Stewart, as a journalist whose recent work has appeared in The New York Times, The Nation, The Atlantic, and The Guardian. She's the author of The Good News Club, The Christian Right's Stealth Assault on America's Children. And she has an op-ed at The New York Times, What the Government School's Critics Really Mean. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.